Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, in the first of our two Premier League season preview podcasts, I'm delighted to welcome back, as always, it's now a bit of a tradition, from Second Captains, Ken Early. Hi, Ken.
Andrew, how are you?
I'm good. How are you feeling about me and you, probably one of three or four people now not working for The Athletic?
Oh, yeah. How am I feeling about it? I'm watching it with great interest.
Yeah.
And I wish everybody well. I mean, I hope I'm not a bit like a kind of, you know, Native American looking down from the mountain at, like, the, you know, the explorers building their first camp, you know, just on the beachside. You know, they seem to be working. They seem like good people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll wait and see. I mean, there's that quote from the founder of The Athletic from a couple of years ago about, like, wanting to rip out the guts of newspapers, kill the pig, drink his blood, or something along those lines.
Yes.
The rhetoric has toned down a little bit now, so.
Yeah.
I've subscribed anyway, so.
Yeah, I subscribed. I took advantage of the 50% offer for the first year.
It's not bad.
It's not bad.
I mean, 29 quid for the year?
Yeah.
I saw something the other day. I mean, it was in the form of a Twitter infographic, which is obviously the ideal medium to transmit lies of all kinds. But it was it was claiming that Britain's membership of the EU was equivalent to £29 per person. The UK's, you know, £29 per person per year. So about the same cost as subscribing to The Athletic at 50% discount. And you get, like, you know, rights to work in other countries and whatnot.
Yeah.
Although obviously these things aren't prized by everybody.
Of course not. If only it had been 52% off, maybe it would have hit the mark. But I mean, it is sort of what the future holds. And obviously you guys at Second Captains have been doing it for a couple of years now, where people pay you a smidgen of money every month for your excellent content, and here at Arsblog people do the same with Patreon. It just seems to be the way that it's going to go. If you want quality content nowadays, you might have to pay for it.
Well, the anomaly was the sort of 20-year period in between when you didn't have to pay for it, you know, because previously, obviously, it wasn't like they were just doling out magazines and newspapers for free. I mean, it was accepted that you, like, bought it, you know, or
the physical edition.
Subscribed to the, yeah, I mean, then the only way of getting it. But, like, you know, the notion that, like, this is some alien concept, I mean, it is sort of the way things have been more or less since the invention of printing until the year 2000, you know.
Yeah. But it has taken a while, hasn't it, for that to catch up in internet terms, for example, where there's an equivalence between what you pay online for a service rather than buying, you know, stuff off wherever you buy stuff, whether it's clothes or gear or Amazon or whatever. You know, people will pay for stuff in that sense. But the idea that a service that you get on the internet, content, might be worth the same amount of money online as in your pocket if you were to go out and buy the same thing in a shop. It has taken a while to get here.
Well, because all the newspapers decided to just put it up on their websites for free. I mean, that's what happened. You know, I mean, why did it happen that way? I guess originally because the people who sort of made the decision to do that didn't use the internet. I mean, they'd kind of grown up in a world without it, and it wasn't really factored in their thinking. It was kind of like,
everyone else is doing it, so should we?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, oh, that'll be a nice sort of additional thing. We can show that we're, like, modern. We have, you know, a website and I suppose we'll just put this up on the website. Sure, nobody uses this thing anyway. You know, that's kind of the way. And then obviously it completely changes the entire world. And it's like, how do we now figure out how to make people pay for our content again, which everybody was doing unthinkingly until it turned out they didn't have to. and it's obviously it's not as though like the time of free content is over. I mean, there's any amount of it, like, but I think it is kind of, you know, people have a appreciation of the fact that the function of content in if you're getting it free is this bait for a hook. You know, it's about something else.
Yeah,
it's like how to get your attention in order to give you the real message, which is about something that you can buy. So I don't know. I think it's going to be if we're talking about the Atlantic, like I've looked at, there's already some good stuff. They've definitely got some really good writers, I hope it goes well. But yeah, I mean, it's not like it's kind of a weird revolution that like gets us back to where we were in like 1453 or whatever it was, you know. So. That's back to the future.
Really. Yeah, okay. So how's your summer been? Are you refreshed from a relative lack of football, even though there has been quite an amount of football on over the summer? The summer seems to be extending longer and longer into June, and then the gap between the end of official football and the start of preseason, and preseason now, of course, is all encompassing. I was away in the States watching Arsenal in LA and Charlotte and DC and following the tour, and it's a big thing now, preseason. How has your summer been? Are you refreshed? And what do you think about this idea that sooner or later we're going to have like a 12-month football calendar with no real respite in the middle?
That's kind of what we're at now. And actually the break this year was longer than the break last year when the World Cup ended 3 weeks before, was it 2 weeks and 6 days before the Premier League started?
Was it?
I think so, yeah. It was July 15th, maybe, the World Cup final, and in around then anyway, and the Premier League was like the first weekend of August.
Right.
So it was like a 3 week break from the final. The final's on Sunday night, and then the Premier League kicks off on Saturday. So this year it's actually 2 days longer, I think, because the African Cup of Nations finished on Friday, and 3 weeks later on the Saturday, the Premier League starts. Yeah. No, actually, it's a Friday, so it was 1 day longer.
Right.
Sadio Mane having the longest season and shortest break out of everybody because he's got to play on Friday.
Well, they can't play him.
They might. They played Salah against Manchester City. I suppose he had an extra week since he'd stopped playing with Egypt, but he hadn't trained much and he just went straight in and played the whole game.
I mean, it's not a case anymore that players are going on summer holidays and coming back 6 pounds or 12 pounds or a couple of stone overweight because they've spent the summer drinking beer and eating fish and chips. You know, it's not really like that anymore in the sense that the fitness work or they stay, I'd say their fitness levels are pretty consistent year round.
Yeah. But did you see Klopp after the Community Shield?
Was this when he was talking about like we should have a 5 or 6 week break and it would make football more interesting?
Yeah,
and
it would make football more interesting for managers, sure, coaches who can, you know, train their team to play three different systems and that gets them very excited. Everyone else is like, we'd like to see a game. So that has to be balanced. And he kind of acknowledged all that. But the point that he made about fitness, it's not so much that like Sadio Mane is going to spend his holidays, you know, getting out of shape and stuffing himself. It's clearly that's not going to happen. And most footballers are like that now. But the problem has to do with what the body can ultimately take. And it's not just that the training, the intensity of the training and the matches, but it has to do with the fact that football is a contact sport. This was the point that he made. Essentially, he said, you can talk to me about sports where they train even way more than footballers. Like if swimmers, for instance, train, you know, 5 hours a day, morning and afternoon, like 11 months a year. So don't come at me, football players, moaning about the fact that you have to play football for an hour and a half, then have a nice lunch, and then go home and play Fortnite. And you only get like June off or a bit of July or whatever, and you get paid like 1,000 times more than a swimmer. The point is that in swimming, there's no contact. So the injuries are ultimately caused by an accumulation of this. Well, I mean, fatigue plus contact equals injury. You know, if your body is tired, if it's, you know, all of the things that your body has to do without you having to pay any attention to it, just to get you running around without falling over on a football pitch, requires, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, millions of tiny little muscular contractions, nerve impulses, and so on and so forth, just so you don't sort of fall over. And that's all fine until you get tired, at which point it's not quite in the same sync as it was. And then suddenly, if you add in a contact, some unexpected movement, falling over or being hit by somebody, that's when you get an injury.
Yeah.
So he's saying, like, if he, ultimately this is going to, this is what's kind of taking the players out. You know, you can have a sport like basketball where they play like every day, it seems, you know, or like they've got like so many games of basketball, but they're then off for like, you know, months and months.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly how long the NBA season is, for instance, but they don't expect you to keep doing that throughout the year. It's intense, but then there's a really long break. So football is just trying to have it both ways. You know, ultimately, the way it is now, I mean, it's interesting that it's the big clubs who are doing most of the moaning about it, in terms of, oh, there's too much stuff on. And I guess they're mainly critical of the fact that there's international football, which they'd rather didn't exist anymore.
But is that not a consequence of them being the big clubs and having European football, which, of course, gives you more games to play, whereas a team below that is, you know, they can play Sunday and then they may not play again until the next Sunday, whereas you could be playing, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, whatever.
Yeah, but big clubs, this system, the more games there are, the better it is for big clubs, because they're the ones that have big squads. And, you know, the managers are complaining about it, but meantime, the clubs are just kind of pressing on with it regardless. You know? So it's like, yeah, of course we're going to go to China, of course we're going to go to Malaysia, you know, America, make money. I mean, what else do you think this thing is for?
So where do you find the balance then between making the sport of football as good as it can be? And like Klopp said, you know, for a manager to be able to play two or three different systems, is that not something that fans can really get into? The idea that your team could be better and more interesting? Or is it just a case of just give me the football? Give me the football. I want the football.
I think usually it's give me the football. Like, who cares how many systems they play? I mean, does anyone care? You know, do most people? No, I don't think so. You know, they'd rather just see the teams playing the whole time. But like, I do think with this sort of pressure that's on, with this kind of constant complaining, they're going to find some way to, it sounds like they want to play fewer games. You know, that's definitely the message you're getting from all these guys. And if they feel that way for long enough, then that is what is going to happen.
So the players or the managers?
The managers and the clubs, you know. I mean, okay, the clubs, again, you know, if there was some way to get paid the same for playing less, they'd all jump.
Well, wouldn't anybody? You know, if you could get paid the same for doing less work, everyone, I think, would do it. But it's not so much the demands that come from fans, but the outside influences on that are broadcasters, TV rights, commercial interests, sponsorship, marketing, people who have attached themselves to football either directly or indirectly. They're the ones, I think, that are probably driving a lot of the decisions that are happening, or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the way that it will work is, you know, to get paid the same or more for playing fewer games, fine. But the problem with that is that this can't apply to everybody. This can only apply to a small select group. So, you know, they'll eventually sort of manage to detach themselves from, you know, the sort of
troublesome domestic leagues and former European Super League, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we'll definitely pare down the domestic leagues a bit. Like, what is there any need for 20 teams to be in the Premier League, really? You know, is there any the Bundesliga seems to get by okay with 34 games.
Yeah.
Obviously, 18 teams as opposed to 20, you know. And all you'd have to do is give a couple of smaller clubs the flick, and you know, this is the type of thing. So it will continue the trend that we've seen all throughout the last 30 years or so, of the bigger clubs kind of diverting more and more of the money into their own and kind of everybody else withering. And you can actually see that. There's been quite a few articles actually about like Bury, Bolton, you know, these clubs, which are having massive problems in the context of like insane transfer fees, like what does Zaha have said, Palace have said, like don't even think about bidding less than 100 million for Zaha.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, like in that's happening in one part of the sport, but like just up the road clubs are
can't pay their players and
This sort of the inflation is sort of drives the greed, people get even greedier, how can we get more of this money, you know, and it's kind of a cycle that ultimately squeezes most people out. So eventually it will just be Real Madrid against Barcelona, just Real Madrid against Barcelona, you know, that's what the trend is working towards.
All right. Premier League is introducing some new rules this year, or football is introducing new rules. There's the kick out rule where the ball doesn't have to go outside the box. How do you think that's going to impact the way teams play, if at all?
You've asked me that, and I saw that Michael Cox had written a piece about this, but I didn't read it earlier.
Okay, so
I will read it. I will read it. I mean, you know, I don't know. It didn't seem like the most enormous. I mean, what it does is obviously it increases the amount of space at the back that you can use to play out from the back.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it should, I imagine, make it easier to play out from the back, or at least increase the number of ways you can do it, which, you know, makes it easier, I guess. How other teams are going to respond to that, I don't know. But playing out from the back, I guess, was happening anyway, even when the ball had to be cleared out of the penalty area.
And yeah.
It kind of had become like the dominant way of playing in the Premier League over the last few years, so I can't see that changing, you know, if that's going to make it. Yeah, I mean, the VAR is a big change.
I guess. Well, that's what I was going to ask you about next. I mean, are you looking forward to VAR? I mean,
it's basically, it doesn't make any sense on a philosophical level, because there's no way of, like, how small does the thing, how small is too small?
Yeah.
For them to intervene.
Well, I mean, it's all about, isn't it, clear and obvious error, but like how small does the error have
to be? You can see it like really clearly on this, like, you know, super high definition, super slow motion footage. Like, it's clear and obvious on that. Like, so are you going to say clear and obvious to the naked eye? Clear and obvious first time around when you see it in real time?
Mm.
You know, should the referee just get one look at a full speed replay and then have to make his decision based on that? Like, I mean, it's nonsense. Like, the point is that there's any infraction, however small, must count if seen.
Right.
And most of them were never seen because you can't, you know, it's the game's moving too fast. Someone's in the way, the game's moving too fast. Like, the way that you see, how many Champions League matches last season are decided by these nonsense penalties?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because when we saw it in the World Cup, I thought, having been quite skeptical about VAR, I thought, okay, it seems to be working quite well. There were some iffy decisions, and the issue of handball in football, for example, gets ever more complicated. It just becomes more and more complicated, and we saw some penalties given in the World Cup where you went, well, that's not a penalty.
Yeah.
But in general, I thought it worked quite well. And then last season in the Champions League, there were times when I was sitting there watching a game thinking, this is absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
Like, it could have been, was it the...
There was Marquinhos, there was the Tottenham one, the Man City got a penalty against Danny Rose.
Yeah, there was the Ajax against Real Madrid, was it Ajax against Real Madrid? I can't remember. Was it certainly a game against Ajax where there was like a wait of maybe 4 minutes.
Juventus, maybe?
Or Juventus. It could have been Juventus, yeah.
A couple of VAR calls.
It could have been Juventus. But there was a brilliant goal scored, and everyone celebrated and said, what a brilliant goal that is. And then they hauled it back to somewhere near the halfway line, and they replayed it over and over again to see, had all of the ball gone out for a throw-in or whatever.
They gave the goal because it hadn't gone out.
It hadn't, but then you're sitting there at that point going like, fuck.
Would they actually have ruled it out for this? Well, they'd have had to. If there'd been an angle that could have demonstrated the ball had gone out, then they would have had to, and it would have been ridiculous. I mean, the biggest example of this type of the thing is obviously the Sterling goal against Tottenham, the last minute Man City
the one where he thought he'd won it.
Yeah. And you can see this horrible I mean, it was obviously everybody, most people watching it probably were delighted to see this happen. Man City celebrating, Guardiola, you know, absolutely, and then just collapsing to his knees and holding his head,
yeah,
as he realizes that this tiny offside, which nobody would have ever noticed, which Tottenham players clearly didn't notice, you know, no one would have seen this. I mean, okay, maybe the linesman would have seen it. In this case, though, when you've got the VAR, the linesman isn't going to flag for that, because what if he's wrong and he kills a move? You know, he's going to wait. So maybe the linesman would have seen that offside. I don't think he would. It would have been a goal, and that would have been fine. You know, there wouldn't have been people going, oh, but...
Yeah, like his toe was offside.
It would have been fine. Like, people got annoyed about these decisions anyway, but that's not going to change. That's the point. It's not actually going to change anything. And then you'll get these situations where tiny and irrelevant things, which have no place in the human perception of a football match, are suddenly being used to, like, strike off perfectly good goals. Like, come on. And also, you know, once it's sort of... You can't overlook those things then. You're kind of trapped in this dynamic of, well, everything has to count. Everything has to count or nothing counts. So you're actually better off with a situation where you had a referee making imperfect decisions, and he always had... He basically always could say, well, look, you know, who's going to see that?
It goes,
you know,
like
you,
that, yeah.
You could kind of see why certain decisions weren't seen. You could understand what had happened. Whereas now the referee has got no excuse. You still have to decide. I mean, it's still some of these decisions are subjective, like penalty decisions. Like, is that a foul? Is that enough to give a penalty? Come on.
There's also the issue of, like, you know, what looks clear cut in slow motion in real time may not, and similarly, something that happens in real time when you slow it down, it doesn't look anything like it. I mean, just for the record, I should point out that Man City decision did at least give Arsenal fans the opportunity to watch Tottenham lose in the final, which was probably the highlight of our season, given the way that it ended up. So it's not all bad, but no, I do know what you mean, and like, are they going to micromanage football games from video?
Yeah, that's what will happen. And I mean, okay, you can already see, like, I think Mane in the Champions League final kicked it deliberately against the hand of, who was it, Sissoko.
Yeah.
I think that's what he did. It looked to me like that was what he was doing. And that's a completely, you know, I'm not saying, oh, what a dirty, devious tactic by Mane. It's like, well, I mean, if they're saying these are penalties, then... I'll have me a penalty, please. I'll have a penalty, because he's been standing there with his arm in the air raised like that for ages. I mean, what else does he expect me to do? You know what I mean? He was standing there. He was pointing. I'm not sure at who, but the hand was there. Man was eventually like, okay, I'm going to go for this. Well, like, that's something that easily players can do. And, like, you'd be crazy not to try to do it. I mean, the World Cup final, there was a ridiculous handball like that. Given for the penalty that Griezmann scored, wasn't it? Was it Mandzukic? I can't remember which Croatian player.
Yeah.
But like, a nonsense. It was the Perisic, I think.
Yeah.
Where the ball, I think maybe it hit his elbow or something, one of those where he's trying to block a cross, and it, you know, this is ridiculous. This is not a penalty. Nobody saw it. I was at it. Nobody saw it. It was just like plays going on. And then suddenly, like, oh no, hang on. And you're like, oh, what's going on? Are they going to give a penalty here? Come on! Like, and then France are ahead, and the game is. So I'm only talking about, like, the final of the World Cup, the final of the Champions League. You know, key matches all the way up to this. Like, all of these things have been determined by this kind of fouls, which previously just wouldn't really have been noticed.
Handball in particular seems the most susceptible to video evidence, because there was the one in the Manchester United game, Man United PSG, was it?
That was the United winner in that
game. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the guy took a shot and the guy jumped, and I don't know where you're supposed to put your arms when you jump, you know.
Ball's going miles over, by the way.
Yeah.
Should that be a thing? Will they have to bring in a thing like cricket?
Like LBW,
Where it's like, well, this ball is flying into the second tier of the stand. Does he deserve a penalty because one of the PSG players has... touched the ball with his elbow.
Yeah.
I mean, the ball was in such an unnatural path. I mean, you talk about the unnatural position of the arms, which have to be in a natural position at, literally at all times, unless they've been wrenched out of the socket. Every position, every hand position is a natural position. But how is Marquinhos supposed to know that? Was it Dallo? I can't remember which United player it was. He's going to try and blast the ball like 30 yards over the bar. How could he possibly have anticipated such an insane shot? Like, that was an unnatural shot. And we're going to give him a penalty for this? I mean, this is obviously, this is ridiculous what I'm saying. It's just to try to underline the ludicrousness of giving that as a penalty. I mean, okay, you can sometimes give them. Like, I remember I used to get annoyed watching John Terry do this. Like, this is kind of the opposite extreme, when Terry would just Schmeichel jump at a shot,
yeah,
and like hit it, and then would be like, oh no, you know, you can't give that, and the ref would be like, I can't, you're right, I'm not going to, you know, that ball was traveling, you know, how could you know the ball was going to hit? And he was kind of gaming the system in the opposite direction.
Yeah,
but now, like, it's you know, it just seems like there's too many of these penalty generators floating around in the penalty area at any given time. You just need to hit someone's arm, and then it's like, come on.
So given that, given the likelihood of an increased amount of penalties being awarded in the Premier League next season, teams with
good penalty takers,
penalty
goalkeepers,
yeah, well, but an Alan Shearer or a Matt Letizia or whatever, have a little bit of an advantage.
Yeah. Well, that seems to, I mean, it was definitely the trend in the World Cup. There was way more penalties in the World Cup. I can't remember the exact figures now.
Yeah.
But there was, like, way more than any previous World Cup. And obviously there's going to be when you've got a whole new super detection system for fouls. And okay, maybe then it's going to have knock-on effects in terms of you can see the players beginning to adapt the way they defend. For instance, the Origi goal in the Champions League final, where Toby Alderweireld would usually put in a much more wholehearted block than he tried, but he's holding his hands behind his back in an effort to demonstrate his innocence in case of any other, in case
the ball gets booted into his hand. Yeah,
yeah, and he doesn't really throw himself into this block as he maybe would have done. The ball just kind of goes under his foot and into the corner.
Yeah,
like, so that's going to happen. And at set pieces, you know, when England were doing so well in the World Cup, a lot of it had to do with their ability to score from set pieces, which I think also had to do with the inability of anyone to, how do we actually defend this now that all of the things we used to do are now ruled illegal? You can't get away with pulling someone's shirt.
Yeah, how are they going to manage that? I mean, it is.
That's why Harry Maguire is maybe turned out to be a lot more than 80 million. Maybe he will be the first 20 goal a season Marion Harris since Van Persie. You know, because I mean, okay, he's pretty good at heading in corner kicks, and now it turns out nobody can obstruct him in any way. So what's to stop this guy busting the net?
Yeah, well, how are they going to find out who's doing the holding, or who's holding who first, or who's holding who more? It's going to be interesting. So
tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow.
Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/arsblog.
Let's talk a bit about the teams, and normally we sort of focus on the top six, and we'll start with what might be the title race, I guess, again, is Manchester City against Liverpool would be the two favourites, I suppose. Do you see Liverpool pushing City as close again? Do you see City being as good as they were?
Yeah. I mean,
are we going to have a title race?
Well, you know, we only had one last year. It was a bit of a mirage in one way, like in the sense that, you know, if you look at all the expected goals and whatnot, I think I was reading some analysis that said Liverpool should have finished with 83 points and they got 97, based on, you know, the goals they should have scored. They obviously scored. You score. I mean, it's always difficult to know with that metric, like, you know, low expected goals. You shouldn't have scored that. But like, if you've got brilliant players who can do crazy things, then like that's the point of having those players. They can do this. You know, like say the Salah goal against Chelsea. Do you remember the one from miles out from a ridiculous sort of. You never see that goal scored, so I don't know what the XG was, in it like 0.1, 0.0000. You know,
yeah.
But like, okay, certain players can do these things. It was a surprising goal, but it wasn't like, I can't believe that my eyes have literally fallen out of my head. How did he, you know, it wasn't maybe as unlikely as the percentage.
Yeah, I mean, does XG need like a the quality of the player added into the chance? Like, I mean, what's an XG for Messi versus an XG for Nicholas Bentner or whatever?
Yeah, so he's like outperforming it the whole time, and it's because he's amazing. But usually when people are outperforming it, it's because they're lucky. You know what I mean? It's like this is, I suppose when you sustain it over a whole career, then you can say, okay, this guy's actually really good. Whereas usually if it's like, oh, someone's way outperforming your XG, then it's like, well, let the buyer beware, because, you know, a lot of things have fallen right for this player. And, you know, sooner or later, you know, gravity always wins and he's going to come back down and regress to the mean. And, you know, you find that you've paid like, you're Gareth Southgate and you've just signed Afonso Alves for like 8 million for Middlesbrough. he scored like 600 goals for his Dutch team.
The Matthias Kesman type thing.
No, it wasn't actually as good as we thought.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I mean, to get back to the point of Liverpool, I do think they it's hard to see them playing better. Whereas with City, I can immediately see how they play better just by the return of Kevin De Bruyne into the team.
Yeah, and they've made a, you know, very good signing as well in Rodri.
Yeah, although Rodri can only really play at the expense of Fernandinho, who's really good for them last season. You know, like that was a strong position for them. But I think De Bruyne would improve any team in the league. Certainly would improve City, when he plays for them, I think he's their best player. I mean, I don't know if that's just something about the style of him as a player that appeals to me. Like, I just like the way he plays. You know, you could, you know, David Silva say I'm not such a huge fan of, but like you'd have people would say, oh, he's incredible. Maybe it's just, maybe those kind of fizzed, I'm just waving my hands around here, but the way that Kevin De Bruyne whips in a low cross, something about that, I'm just like, yeah, this is what it's all about. Whereas David Silva's like flitting, you know, between the lines and, you know, shadow play and all this kind of stuff. I'm just like, what's he doing?
Making him, of course, the greatest foreign player ever to play in the Premier League.
I don't get it. Not for me. You know, so what I'm saying is they've got him to come back in. He is going to be, you know, if he can stay fit this time, how can they not be better with a fully fit opponent? And with Liverpool, you don't really see that. Okay, they've got like Oxlade-Chamberlain missed the whole season, but like he's not in that class. Like he was good for them the season that he did play, but he's not going to. I find it hard to imagine winning Player of the Year, which of course Kevin De Bruyne didn't manage to do, but only because the guy who beat him broke the Premier League goal scoring record. You know what I mean? I think Oxlade-Chamberlain is quite at that level. They've got Naby Keita, who didn't do anything last season effectively until the last couple of months.
Yeah,
kept getting injured. He's the player that they need to see improvement from if they want to. They need everyone else to keep doing what they're doing, and they need him to start playing like a £56 million signing, or at least two years ago when they made that deal, when it was still a lot of money.
Yeah. So you're looking at the City machine just crushing it again.
I think so, but you know, it's hard to, like, with City, the season last season was almost perfect, apart from like losing three matches in four. Wasn't that what they did?
It was around
December.
January, or wasn't it? Yeah, because Liverpool at one point could have gone 10 points clear. Yes. Is that right? Yeah.
They could have gone 10 points clear. They were 7 points clear with an extra game played when they played City.
Yeah.
I can't remember. City pulled it back to four by beating them. That was Liverpool's only defeat, but that was enough. So this is what it's like with City. Like, I think Klopp has been quite cranky in his public appearances, press conferences and stuff over the last few weeks, mainly because he's usually talking after his team has lost, because they've been losing other preseason games, and you know, he's kind of annoyed about, oh, I don't have, my players are coming back late, and this, he's been doing all this complaining about all the extra football they're playing.
Yeah,
but underlying that is the fact that he knows, like, he cannot afford to start slowly. You know, they lost it last season after getting 97 points. They won what, their first five or six games in a row, barely conceded a goal, I think, for the first few weeks of the season. And you need to do that to have any chance. If you don't do that, forget it. So you're in a situation where the league season, it's like, well, we're concentrating on the Champions League now in mid-September. That's what Man City can do. I don't think anyone else can really do that. With City, everybody else basically has to hope that what Guardiola has said about being a manager for a long time at one club is true. When Guardiola's at Barcelona, he's like, you know, he left. Remember Alex Ferguson? I think Guillaume Balaguer did a book about Guardiola where he got Alex Ferguson to do the foreword, and Ferguson wrote in that, I couldn't understand what this guy was doing. Like, why would you walk away from Barcelona? I thought it was crazy. Like, I think he said he spoke to Guardiola. He said, what are you doing? You don't leave a job like this. You will never have a job as good as this again. You will never have a squad of players like you have at Barcelona again in your career. And I just don't understand why anybody would, in this perfect situation. Okay, not perfect. There's things that you don't like. There's directors you don't get on with. The media are a pain in the ass. But, like, that's the job. And you should stick with this. Guardiola's like, no, they don't listen to me anymore. They stopped listening. You know, you're only going to listen to any coach for a certain amount of time.
But is that, I mean, I know we've talked about this before. I'm not sure it's necessarily true of every coach. It might be true of a coach like Guardiola.
He's a maniac.
Yeah, I didn't watch the Amazon thing, but I watched some clips from it, and it's like, fuck me.
It's full on.
Like
he's a headbanger.
He is definitely an amazing football coach, but not somebody that you would want to spend every day of your life working.
Well, there
with.
Was a story, you know, you'd seen that story that one of the coaches, one of the Man City coaches, was told he was out of shape.
The coach was out of shape.
Like, if he wanted to go on the tour, like, he was going to have to lose some weight, because it was sort of demoralizing to see, for the players to see this.
A slightly chubby man.
To see this whale looking at him from this, and it's like, oh, I can't believe this guy's supposed to be an example.
I can't believe it. Guardiola is so forward thinking. How could he be body shaming or fat shaming a guy like
that? Guardiola himself is in great shape, you know, El Flaco or whatever. Like, I don't know. That's just a rumor. I don't know. It's just a rumor. But it's believable. It's believable that he would do that. It's like, these are the standards, guys. You know,
it's
all about,
I'm telling you, guys.
I mean, it's a bit like Arsene Wenger used to be like that, in terms of, yes, I'm a 68-year-old man who, for some reason, inflicts a footballer's diet on myself. you know, because I believe it is important to be an example to the players. You know,
sure.
So he takes that to extremes. I mean, you know, is it too much? I get the impression that the City players are mostly quite enjoying it. You know, I don't look at them, like, obviously Sané is the kind of exception. We'll wait and see if he's still at Man City this season. There's something wrong, obviously, with between him and Guardiola. It's not really connecting. Because maybe it's something that happens more with the more exceptionally talented players, which Sané is, I guess, in the sense that both because Guardiola's way of looking at the game is so collective and so tactical that, like, it kind of is a bit... you can imagine someone super talented, somebody like Ibrahimovic, or actually even Messi towards the end at Barcelona, beginning to think, this guy, like, why doesn't he just let me do what I do? I'm the footballer. Let me play the football and stop telling me what I've got to do the whole time.
Yeah.
For a really talented player who maybe still kind of thinks of the football field as a place where I can kind of enjoy myself and
or express, as Wenger always used to say, you know, a place for players to express themselves.
Yeah, that they might start to find this a bit overbearing.
Yeah.
It has to do maybe with their own kind of personal humility as well. Like, you know, how long can you sort of keep respecting Guardiola as somebody who has new things to tell you about the game? It seems to me that most of them are still in that zone. You know, like players like Sterling. I guess it has to do as well with, like, look at how the sort of progress Sterling is making season after season. Like, for Man City, anyway, he's absolutely lethal now. Like, he's phenomenal now. And he's always been a good player, but, like, he's just become so focused and so effective. So when you're seeing those types of results in your own game, when you can see I'm like he was the other front runner for Player of the Year last season. When you see that happening, it's like, well, this is working, you know. And as long as you don't start to think this is working because of me, I'm the great one here, it's all about me.
Yeah.
As long as you can go, well, this is working because I'm working with Pep, working with these teammates. They make me better. He makes me better. It's all a virtuous circle. You know, then you can keep it going for a while. But, you know, if you get to the point where you're like, I wish this guy would just lay off. I mean, there's a story, I think, in the Balague book about how Messi, like, one of the moments when Guardiola realized, oh, I've got some problems here at Barcelona, was when Messi stood up and defiantly walked over to the Coke machine, like, got himself a Coke and then drank it, like, looking, sort of, I don't know if he's like making eye contact with Guardiola the whole time as he drank this, like, full fat Coke,
looking at him like through, like the guy in the Diet Coke ads.
What you gonna do about it, Pep?
Yeah,
what you gonna do about it? So what, I like Coke, I'm gonna have a Coke, I'm the best player in the world, I'm gonna have a Coke. And Guardiola's like, he knows I don't want him to do that, and yet here he is. You know, if they're not listening, I'd better move on. You know, I can educate some other footballers. These guys think they know it all. You
right.
know what I mean?
Well,
so, but at the moment, it doesn't look like City are in a rebellious class who've lost respect for the teacher.
Right. We'll have to wait and see if Raheem Sterling comes in with an iron brew one day, and we'll know that Guardiola's time at City is up. Yeah. Manchester United have spent some money. Obviously, they brought in Aaron Wan-Bissaka from Crystal Palace. The guy from Swansea is now Daniel James, who's very, very fast, apparently. Harry Maguire is the most expensive defender of all time, which is an amazing thing to me. How do you view what's going on there? Because they still have some problems. Obviously, there's the Lukaku issue is rumbling on. They've got Alexis Sanchez, who they would like to get rid of, I'm sure. But because they're paying him, you know, the guts of £500,000 a week or whatever it is, it becomes very difficult to find a destination for a player like that. And Solskjaer had that amazing run, which got him the job, but... You know, I don't follow Manchester United Twitter by any means, but from time to time, stuff gets tweeted into my timeline, and it strikes me that perhaps he's not the most all-round choice for many of their fans, that they reckon he's not quite the guy. So how do you view the season ahead for United?
Well, obviously, I think there's a lot of latent hostility, which... will absolutely explode at the first sign of things going wrong. You know, you could see this at the end of the season when Paul Pogba was being abused by these...
I remember
United,
that clip,
United
yeah.
fans, like, why don't you put it on Instagram? Like, this rage, like, you know, this, like, rage. And it's it's clearly about more than just, Pogba, you haven't played very well for us in the last few weeks, what's going on?
Yeah.
There was a bit more to it than that. There was some bigger hostility being tapped into there, like, in terms of, like, what Pogba represents, you know, sort of culturally, like, these Man United fans. Like, now, I'm not saying that's all Man United fans, but you could see them at Old Trafford. I mean, the video is there. You can see Pogba was kind of shouting back at them, like, what are you talking about? You know, there's a very angry group of people there. And once things start to go wrong, I noticed, for instance, you say you don't follow United. I noticed yesterday, or was it? No, it was actually today. Fellaini was trending on Twitter in Ireland. Fellaini, right? What was Fellaini trending? He's been in China for ages. What's he doing? Has he scored an amazing goal? Has he suffered a horror injury? What has happened? So I checked for Fellaini, and it appeared that Fellaini was trending in Ireland purely because of angry Man United fans writing, we haven't replaced Herrera or Fellaini. This is an absolute joke. How can we be here just before the transfer window closes? Oh, we haven't. And, you know, and then they were listing out, like, who have we got? Matic, Pogba, to play central midfield. Yeah. Matic, Pogba, Pereira, McTominay. And who's the other one? Oh, God, there's one other.
I can't remember.
Oh, Jesus. Matic, get up the
You're
squad there.
Man United.
Get up the squad. There was basically five. This is going to be embarrassing when we...
That's fine. Really, it's obvious, okay.
Really obvious Man United player. But okay, so five players for...
Juan Mata?
Does Juan Mata count as a midfielder?
I don't know
if he's been counted.
Fred,
of course, that was
Fred. Right.
How could we forget? Okay, Fred. To be fair,
sorry, Fred.
He showed some good things and some bad things last season. You know, everybody needs a little bit of time to adapt. I wouldn't be like Fred's a joke. You know, get out of here, Fred. I wouldn't be saying that just yet. I think that he does have some things going for him. But okay, so that's the five for central midfield. And okay, and you've lost the thing. You notice that there's nobody new there, and they've lost Herrera, who was a pretty solid player for them, I think. And to be honest, I was a bit surprised they let him go. I guess it had to do with a combination of the money he was looking for and the age that he was, which is to say 30. He's looking for, you know, a contract to rival whatever PSG were offering, which, yeah, I'm sure was a lot with him coming off a free transfer to them. But, you know, he was a good player. He'd been there for, 5 years, had played in, you know, I mean, I can't say it's been a good spell for Man United. It's not like he's been absolutely amazing, but I do think he'd be a player I would have put in my first 11 for them. Can do quite a lot of things well. He's a good player to have in the squad. He's gone. Fellaini's gone. Fellaini was obviously a kind of a hate figure and a joke figure and a cult figure, all these things at once, but like, I think he should have gone years ago. There's no point really in having a midfielder like this. Obviously, he scored some goals from headers and stuff. They got Harry Maguire now, you know.
Yeah.
They can put him up front in the Fellaini situation. If it's like, oh, if only we had Fellaini to come on and batter them, you know.
Plan B.
Yeah, they've got a plan B in old Maguire. But like, how can they have done this again? You know, we're still waiting. This is the transfer window. Still has about 24 hours to go.
We're recording on Wednesday. Yeah.
So maybe there's going to be someone coming in. But this is cutting a bit fine. How could you, having had a poor season, where you know you've got a lot of ground to make up, and you've got a new manager who you want to support, supposedly, and all this kind of stuff, and midfield has been a problem for you all this bad season, and now you've lost two of your midfielders. I mean, Fellaini went in January or February, right? I mean, Herrera just at the end of the season, although he didn't actually play much for the last couple of months. But this has been an obvious issue, and they haven't done anything about it. So again, you're just kind of holding your head going, how is this possible? Like, you know, how can they... When you see that, you don't have a lot of confidence that
the people making the decisions of the club are capable of making good decisions.
I mean, there has been like obviously a bit of a change in terms of the players that they've gone for. You know, Daniel James is like a 21-year-old with potential. Wan-Bissaka is kind of the same, really, even though his fee was pretty big. And you know, they've ended up having to pay pretty much what Leicester originally asked for Harry Maguire, which, again, you're kind of like, maybe they should have just done that. He could have played pre-season. It would have made a big difference, would have made things a lot easier for him. Whatever about that. And then not signing Dybala, you know, how much of that was Dybala saying, I'm not sure I really want to join these guys, but like, if they will pay me $500,000 a week, then sure.
Yeah.
Will they? Oh, no, it turns out that's too much for them. Okay, well then,
yeah,
we don't need to talk about that. But you know, So there isn't like a Sanchez. Like I mentioned Sanchez, which I always feel is a little bit unfair to them, because I certainly didn't think when Sanchez joined them that it was going to be as big of a disaster as it's turned out to be.
Neither did I. You know, when it went through, we could see signs at Arsenal that maybe there was a decline going on, but then this part of you going, is it because he just doesn't want to be at Arsenal anymore? Mm. He was fucked off the way that previous summer went, where he thought he was going to go to Man City and then it was, you know, taken away right at the last minute. Are his performances a measure of his mind, or what do you call it? His state of mind, rather. Mm. You know, he's disappointed. He doesn't want to be here. You know, it's hard to motivate himself. But yeah, I mean, he's gone right off a cliff. It is, I think, in both ways, with Mkhitaryan coming to Arsenal. I think it's the worst swap deal in football history.
Yeah, Arsenal came out of it better, though, right?
Not much.
Because Sanchez would have left on free, and then that would have been it.
Yeah, and we wouldn't have a 200 grand a week lightweight.
Yeah, you think?
In Mkhitaryan, who just hasn't provided any consistency at all. I think they'd be quite happy to move Mkhitaryan on if there are anyone out there who's going to take on that kind of wage packet. But the clubs who can do that are very few and far between.
Yeah, and you do see a few of these players, you know, obviously Ozil, Sanchez, Coutinho, who are kind of marooned on massive wages and... maybe in 24 hours the position of one or other of these players will have changed, but it's difficult for the clubs who sign them to offload them. And United are obviously very wary of getting into that situation again, you know, so they've gone with like players who aren't going to do that. But you know, it's you know, as opposed to previously, oh, Angel Di Maria, you know, he played for Real Madrid, you know, that's pretty sexy.
Yeah.
Let's get in Sanchez, you know, he's sort of top. Whereas now they're kind of like, okay, who might actually be a good player for us for several years? You know, and that's kind of, there's a bit more of that sort of thinking, which I think is good for them. But at the same time, it's like, who forgot to sign an extra midfielder? Five players for three positions is not really enough, especially when two of them in Pereira and...
Fred?
No, McTominay. Pereira and McTominay are like young players, like, you know, very inexperienced players who could turn out to be very good, you know, but like you can't expect them to be good every week. Pogba has openly said, I do not want to be here. Like, he's openly said, I fancy a new challenge. Like, it couldn't have been any clearer about it. And it's not like he's got, you know, it's not like he's shown previously that he's the sort of player who, denied his preferred option, will do, say, what Luis Suarez did when he couldn't join Arsenal in 2013 and basically play so hard the following season there was absolutely no chance he was going to ever have to play another season for Liverpool. You know, he's absolutely determined that there is no way I'm still going to be here in 12 months. I'm going to go out there and be the man of the match in every game.
Somebody's going to fucking buy me.
It would be great for Man United if Pogba was to do that, but what seems more likely at the moment is kind of inconsistency. Some days he's good, some days he's not. He sort of loses interest for periods of the season.
Yeah.
It's very easy for him, I think, to sort of throw up his hands and go, well, what the fuck do you expect me to do? Look what I'm surrounded by here.
Fred.
What's the plan? What's the program? Like, what am I supposed to do here? You expect me to run this whole thing myself? Like, it's kind of easy for him to do that.
Yeah.
They give him too many outs. And then you've got the fact that they can still sell him between, you know, the transfer deadline and the end of
September. Yeah, I mean, he could kick up, you know.
He could, but like the thing is, they can't sell him. If they don't bring in somebody else, they can't. They'd be down to like four players for three positions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And one of them is Matic, two of them are like young players, and then you've got Fred, and that's the midfield.
Come on. Make it happen.
That's clearly not, it's clearly not going to work. Make like, you can only imagine they have to bring somebody in. We'll know better in 24 hours. But there's a lot of issues there, which I don't think Harry Maguire is necessarily going to solve all by himself.
No, I don't think so. Frank Lampard at Chelsea.
Yeah. I quite like Frank Lampard in a weird way.
I, you know, obviously have never been a fan of him, given where he plays and everything else, but I don't think he's the worst.
Yeah. I mean,
maybe he
amuses me
greatly.
I enjoy watching him because he's kind of actually quite combustible. For a guy who sort of, I think he kind of he sort of projects a certain, like, English unflappability.
Yeah.
You know, when people used to think English people were unflappable, like when Lampard was a player. Things have changed, obviously, since his retirement. Things have all these long-held stereotypes are beginning to change. But Lampard's got that kind of, you know, don't worry, I've got this type of RAF, Battle of Britain mentality. That's what he tries to project. But actually, he's incredibly sensitive to insult and always reacts to any provocation. which is a great mix. Because you got, like, you know, for a lot of the time, he's sort of stiff upper lip and, like, you know, this sort of... And then suddenly he's just absolutely losing
it. The lead stuff from last year.
Yeah, brilliant. Amazing stuff. Amazing. And, like, we haven't heard the last of that song. Like, we're going to be hearing a lot. I mean, the Leeds fans, it only made sense in the context of Leeds having beaten Derby in, like, Home and Away or whatever. But I think that lyrics can be just ignored or whatever, because the important lyric is the Stop Crying Frank Lampard lyric. And we will be hearing that, I'm sure, quite a lot. But, like, you know, I think it's a really interesting situation for Chelsea to be in now, because obviously they've got this transfer ban. So things are, that's not good. And they've lost Hazard, and that's not good.
No.
But
they have got, they did bring in Pulisic. They did the deal for Pulisic in January, and they've made Kovacic permanent, but that's it. I mean, like, he is going to have to delve into the youth system and the 500 young players that they've got at the club.
Yeah, it's long overdue. Like, I mean, again, like, Chelsea's youth system is a bit weird, because it turns out they kind of spotted, or have been running it this way. Anyway, this is quite a good way for us to make money. You know, this is, we can kind of, we're like a little, you know, bank of players, and we buy low and sell high, and, you know, it's actually you can make a lot of money doing this. And if you've got the capital to start it off in the first place, which obviously wasn't a problem for Chelsea back in the day, and that's kind of been how they've used it, because they've appointed managers who don't use the players, coming out of there, and so it's been a bit of a graveyard. Obviously, for there's lots of players who've left and kind of gone on to better things elsewhere, I guess. But, like, until recently, with, like, Loftus-Cheek and Hudson-Odoi, both of whom have now got long-term injuries. Although apparently Hudson-Odoi, I mean, he snapped his Achilles, I heard, but maybe back as soon as September, which sounds kind of crazy. I imagine he's not going to be a factor too much in the first half of the season.
Yeah.
But, like, it's past time that they started trying to do this at Chelsea. Like, you know, obviously John Terry kind of arrived into their team that way, and Lampard was a bit different, but he did join them very young. When he would have been 22, I think, when he joined Chelsea.
Can't remember.
And, like, they were like the kind of foundation of the team for 10 years. Maybe you know, Terry maybe stayed too long or whatever, but it at least gave you something to slot other pieces around. And they haven't sort of had that, I think, for a while now. You know, in the sense of, this guy is going to want to stay here his whole career. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
You know, I don't know if they would even have that with the youth players, but, like, they should have been trying to develop their own players long before this. And with Lampard coming in and the transfer ban, that buys him a lot of leeway, I think. And he can do this. He can see if, you know, he can try a few things.
Yeah, it certainly gives him time, and I think his reputation or his status with Chelsea fans as well. Obviously gives him a bit more time than somebody like Sarri, who at the end of the day got them into the Champions League, won a European trophy, and everyone hated him.
Yeah. It's Chelsea, like, you know.
Yeah, of course.
The same with Benitez. You know, Benitez, they just hated Benitez. It was just like, no, not this guy. And he's like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that he's doing really well. the team seems to be playing well. And we just don't want him. Just get rid of him.
Yeah.
And that seemed to happen at quite an early point with Sarri. I mean, Sarri didn't really help himself with the whole Hudson-Odoi stuff. You know, like, that kind of Italian attitude to young players where you're like, no, we don't. He could have been more diplomatic. He could have, like, Lampard is not going to have that problem. Right, Lampard is the opposite. He's like an absolute legend for Chelsea. He knows exactly how to say things, what kind of, you know, what's going to go down well, what's not going to go down so well.
Yeah.
What all the questions that are coming at him in a press conference, what they really about.
Yeah, and it's going to take a lot for the fans to turn on him, even if results or whatever don't go well.
I mean,
you would think it would take there might be an element of patience.
Look at Solskjaer, you know what I mean? Like, Lampard is a bigger Chelsea legend than Solskjaer.
Sure.
But, you know, Solskjaer is a very much a beloved player of days gone by.
Mm.
I mean, you know, he could be out there pretty quickly. Yeah. You know, with people going, look, I love you as a player, Ollie, but this just isn't good enough. So it could happen with Lampard. But I do think the circumstances in which he's taken over are actually all really good because they're bad. Like, he comes in at a club where they've just lost their best player. They're not allowed to sign players. They're probably feeling a bit insecure. This is all good for the new manager.
Yeah, it's like taking over in government after the last government has caused a financial crash, because you can just blame everything on
completely like
on them.
So it gives him that sort of it means the expectations are much lower than they otherwise would have been, than they usually are at Chelsea. Mm. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how it works out. I mean, what is not really clear yet with Lampard is how good is he as a manager?
Yeah,
you know, like, we don't really know. Like, with Derby, they were quite good. They had some great results last season. They knocked Man United out of the League Cup. You know, they
seem to play decent football.
Yeah, sometimes, but not always. You know what I mean? They finished sixth. Like, they managed to beat Leeds in a kind of an insane game. But, like, I'm not sure how much influence Frank Lampard had over it. In fact, I think one of the, again, my memories are so fuzzy now, there's so many games, but the Derby's approach in the first game, I think, was really criticised. You know, he kind of got it wrong or picked the wrong team from the outset, and of course the substitute does the damage or whatever, but like, why wasn't he playing? You know, it wasn't as though, wow, Lampard's really, he's completely blown everyone away. Like, nobody was talking about Derby. In fact, lots of people were. Like, that's why Lampard went there. You know, they're kind of a club that was, you know, had deeper pockets than some of the other championship clubs. So, like, that remains to be seen. But I do think I think he's well placed to capitalize on a promising situation, more promising than has greeted any Chelsea manager in recent years. They have had stronger teams in that time. I don't think they're going to win the league, obviously, but it's a good situation for him to take over Chelsea, I think.
So let's talk Arsenal. And the end of last season was very disappointing, obviously, not finishing in the top four when they should have. And the defeat in the Europa League final to Chelsea, which can happen in a final. I think the bigger issue was the fact that the team had a terrible run of results at the business end of the season and finished, I think, a point off the top four. Considering the gap, the previous season was sort of 13 points between Arsenal and the top four. There was, if you want to step back and look at it slightly objectively, an improvement, which I think is maybe looking for a silver lining that isn't quite there. But in terms of the attack and in terms of midfield, Arsenal look in pretty good shape.
Mm.
Signing Nicola Pepe.
Mm.
That was a surprise
to
me. Yeah, he looks. We had a great season at Lille, and definitely a surprise.
Scores penalties, of course.
Yeah, of course. In this new VAR Premier League, it could be very important.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, midfield. There's some talent in there. I think with Torreira and Guendouzi and Ceballos in from Real Madrid.
Torreira's sticking around.
Yeah, mm. Yeah. I think that was just
the last of the Sven signings.
Yeah, maybe so. They like him, though. So, you know, he's in his second season in England, so realistically should be a bit better. Guendouzi as well should be better.
Yeah, I think Guendouzi was good last season.
Mm.
You know, I mean, he's got a lot going for him.
He does. He's got a bit to learn still, I think, about how the Premier League works. He does this thing where he goes over a bit too often looking for the free kick, you know, under pressure from behind. And you don't always get that in the Premier League. And that's something he's got to learn. And there's some, you know, some really good young talent at Arsenal now. Joe Willock coming through, who's been brilliant all summer. Amazing.
Mm.
Reece Nelson, Saka, Eddie Nketiah, who might go out on loan. Again, there's still time, but defensively, you talked about Manchester United not buying the players that they need in midfield. Arsenal defensively are in a mess.
Well, I have no idea what they think they're doing. It's crazy.
I don't know what they think they're doing either. I mean, Lauren Koscielny, the Koscielny situation At the time of recording, he was due to speak to the French press at some point this afternoon to talk a bit more about his departure. But what was clear from what he said and after he left was that he's been in discussions with the club for months about his desire to leave. And normally when a player is adamant that they want to leave the club, it is the right thing to do just generally to make that happen. I'm not saying Arsenal should have let him go for free, but an acknowledgement that, right, okay, this guy doesn't want to be here anymore.
Yeah,
that's never a good place to be for a footballer. So you try and make it happen, and it's, you know, 2 days before the window closes, he's gone to Bordeaux in really contentious style. And Holding is still coming back from injury. Bellerin is still coming back from injury. Mustafi is a problem that they can't seem to fix. Callum Chambers, I don't know. I mean, he could be better than I hope he's going to be, and I hope he is.
He could be better than you hope.
Yeah, he could be.
You don't even dare to hope that he'd
be. It's just difficult because you know, he played all last season for Fulham in midfield.
Yeah,
I thought he did okay for us at the end of the previous season. He had some good moments, but there are things about his game that don't seem to be improving. You've got Socrates, who's a yellow card magnet and is going to miss some games and what have you. So they've been trying to buy a left back all summer and they haven't managed to get that over the line.
Yeah.
So for a team whose main problem was its defense, to have done nothing with the defense but make it worse, isn't good strategy at this moment in time, bearing in mind something could happen between now and 5 o'clock tomorrow.
Right, Sam Leahy just pulls them over the seat. Yeah. Edu and Sam Leahy.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really interesting. Like, I'll tell something that happened last season was, remember when Arsenal played Liverpool in the around about Christmas and they went to Anfield and lost 5-1?
Yeah. 5-1.
They scored the first goal and then they conceded like a bunch of goals in about 3 minutes. And there was some ridiculous goals as well. Like the ball sort of loosely booted into the area and Firmino's tapping it in. And then Firmino just sort of walks through.
Well, that was the one that sticks in my mind. There's one where it could have been Firmino where he just ran straight and like the two Arsenal defenders, Mustafi in particular, just sort of looked at him and fell over with panic.
They sort of fell over his side and was it Torreira running in at the end and sort of sprawled on the ground. What is going on? Okay, before that game, a friend of mine had sent me some like WhatsApp messages saying, look, apparently Mustafi isn't fully fit to play today, but he's going to play because Emery doesn't rate any of the other defenders, essentially. But watch Mustafi come off early in this game. And if I'm not mistaken, he didn't reappear for the second half.
Well, I'll have to have a look at that.
It was like, okay, that's sort of interesting because, like, the fact he's like, watch him come off early. Maybe he even came off during the first half, but I'm pretty sure he was gone by halftime. Now, I thought that was interesting because it was like, okay, this information is true.
What sort of position is your friend in to be aware of how Emery rated
fake
the
news,
defender?
Purveyor of fake news. So I was like, all right, that's interesting. Now, obviously, the bit that is kind of...
Halftime.
Now, the bit that looks like, okay, that's true. Now, bearing in mind, this was before the match, this message comes through. So it's like, okay, let's see what happens. So he does go off. It's like, right, okay. So the second bit looks like the second bit is true. You know, he maybe had some pre-existing niggle before the game. He's a bit reluctant about it. He's like, oh. The question, though, is was the first bit true? The Emery wants him to play because, like, he's like, Skodran, I need you. You know, you're my rock.
Well, that's terrifying.
Well, that's okay. You can't tell. You can only sort of guess. But like, if that was the case, right? Okay, obviously I guess that's changed now. Maybe I hope it's changed. I hope it's changed.
Well, it appears to be as it stands, based on the last game that we played against Barcelona on Sunday, which is kind of our last preseason game, that Chambers and Socrates is his first choice pairing of the three central defenders he has available to him right now, with Mustafi the third choice, but just by default, just by being there. I think it is a case that if they could get anyone to take him, they would have, which... is complicated, of course, by the fact that Koscielny is gone, who I think they were planning on keeping, bringing maybe somebody else in, and then you could sell Mustafi. But as it stands, I don't think Arsenal can sell Mustafi simply because they don't have enough players in that position. And as poor as I think Mustafi is, and as badly as I want us to move on from him, with 24 hours left in the window, I'm not sure what we can do in the market that would allow us to sell Mustafi.
Well,
which is, you know,
it's losing Koscielny is worse than it seems, I think, because Koscielny is okay. It was an Achilles injury,
yeah,
and that's a bad one, particularly at his late stage of the career. And there's reasons there to doubt, you know, can he still play in the Premier League at his age with this injury? Okay, maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. But the thing is that he had been, if I'm not mistaken, he's the longest serving player at the club, or at least he must be good enough. He was there since 2010.
Yeah, he was the longest serving player. The longest serving player is now Emi Martinez, our reserve goalkeeper.
Right, okay. So he's got to be the institutional memory of connecting Arsenal with the past generations. Well, there's Edu there as well, I suppose.
Yeah.
But like, okay, the point is that if you were to look at Arsenal squad and say, okay, who's the basic player, who's the fundamental player in the defence? You would say probably Koscielny. I mean, you know, if everyone's fit and theoretically in form or whatever, he's probably getting into the team and he's the captain. You know what I mean? Who is that now? If I ask you that question now about this Arsenal defence, who is the sort of boss of this defence?
Well, it can only be Socrates.
Right.
So, and yeah, I mean, that's who it is right now.
Okay. So he's a player who's a little past his best years as well. He's flanked by Mustafi, who, the problem that Mustafi has now is that his credibility is so shot that, like, anything even looks like a mistake and the whole stadium is going to be, rah, you know, half of them laughing at, or the away fans laughing, and the Emirates crowd getting right on him, right? And that's he's in a debt spiral career-wise at Arsenal.
I agree completely.
Now he could he puts in absolutely heroic performances. He can claw back some of this, but, like, you know, he doesn't really look capable of doing it with this sort of lack of confidence surrounding him. It's a vicious circle. They needed someone to sort of change that, because the other thing about defenders, I mean, defending is like a team game, right? Three defenders, four defenders, plus the goalkeeper, they're judged individually, but what they're doing is working, they're actually working together. You always say, oh, this guy made a mistake, it's his fault. But, like, the defenders will know that's not really the case. A good defense is a team defense. And at the moment, I just don't understand who's even supposed to. Where do you even start with Arsenal's defense? What's going on here? Like, you could actually have the players could be better individually than they're showing, but because there's no real structure there, it's just a rabble of individuals, and they're all looking even worse than you know what I mean. Like, it's they. I can't believe they haven't signed anybody.
No.
I mean, okay, there was the whole financial constraint. You know, we're always hearing about Arsenal's financial constraint.
Yeah, but they just, hang on, yeah, I mean,
It doesn't matter what year it is, it's always financial constraint.
Sure, okay, but they've just gone out and spent a big chunk of money on, or committed a big chunk of money to Pepe.
Yeah.
They've brought in the young central defender from France, Saliba, who they've loaned back. Yeah, so he's, yeah, I mean, look.
Yeah,
that you can find some method in that madness. You know, if in 2 years' time that guy is the cornerstone of the Arsenal defense, if this is what you had to do to get it done, then fine. Yeah. But yeah, you know, you can't. I don't think there's any excuse to not bring in a good defender. If you're willing to go out and spend all that money on a winger, and it's not that Arsenal don't need or didn't need a winger. Of course they did.
Yeah.
I think Pepe is a great signing, but you can't just appear to have ignored this massive hole. I mean, Arsenal conceded 102 goals in the last two seasons in the Premier League. They knew the Koscielny thing. They must have known the Koscielny thing was an issue. Like, the way he behaved, not acceptable. You're the captain of the club. You can't refuse to go on the tour and everything else. Ultimately, he got what he wanted. Arsenal are still in a position where they have a big problem with the center of their defense.
I don't get it. Like, because it's so obvious. So this is what makes me wonder if something is going to happen in the next 24 hours, and this, we could end up sounding very foolish. But I don't understand how it's just in the most basic level. It's like you look at the, you look at your squad, you look at your team, you're like, how many players have we got who can play here, 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 and here? And you know, where are we weak? Any Arsenal supporter looking at what had happened last season would be like, well, this is one thing we clearly need, you know, defenders, even just for numbers, you know, players are going to get injured, and they haven't done that. Like, it's going to be interesting to see what else happens. You know, there was the whole, you know, I saw Josh Kroenke's letter to the fans or whatever. I speak for my father and all this.
Yeah.
You know, talking about the modern infrastructure and the, you know, head of football and blah, blah, you know. And obviously, this, they've been kind of trying to put together a hierarchy for a while now, and kind of the first edition of it fell flat. Like, Gazidis's idea of bringing in Sven Mislintat, they're both gone. But I don't know if you read the Christoph Biermann book. Christoph Biermann, who's a German football writer.
Oh, I heard you talking about it on the podcast, all right.
Yeah. His book is called Football Hackers, and it's like a, it's a book all about basically analytics, essentially. But he talks to Mislintat in that, and he says at one point that the reason Mislintat left was because he spent a bit of time laying out what it is Mislintat does, and you know how he sort of was, what he was doing at Dortmund and this kind of system he put together. Like, he talks about, say, for instance, how Arsenal signed Torreira, and it was because Mislintat was like, oh, I want to buy a player who's a bit like N'Golo Kante. I'd like to buy him, but I can't. So I'll put him in, and then I'll press a button on my, you know,
Jumbotron 2000.
Sven-tron. the Sven-tron. And I press a button saying, give me guys who are a bit like this guy, and it spat out Torreira. Well, not just him. I mean, the other day had like Fabinho, and like, was Guendouzi on that list? I mean, there was a few sort of players, but like, that's literally how he found him. Or he's like, okay, well, you know, saying this guy is similar, and let's have a look. Let's go looking for this guy.
That's how you identify the targets, the scout,
So they found Torreira. Torreira, you know, I thought was one of the qualified successes. I mean, things seemed to go a bit not so well towards the end. Like, it was like, hang on, this guy just runs around fouling people the whole time. This is, how can he continue to get away with this? But referees started to notice. But like, he did have a great spell. First half of the season was very good. But anyway, getting back to the point, why Mislintat left, according to the Biermann book, it was because essentially of a total clash of approaches with Sanlehi, who preferred to do business by, you know, in the kind of old school way of calling up agents and like doing it that way. Like, I heard it on the grapevine, you know, like just sort of putting out feelers and seeing what's going on and who's available and all this, doing it that sort of way. Whereas Mislintat is like, no, the answers are here in the data. We must look to the data. You don't learn anything by talking to agents. All they want to do is rip you off. I mean, that would be his attitude because he's very German, you know.
Sure, but I mean, I don't think that's a point of view that people would find hard to differ with. Like, the idea that a football agent might just be out for the football agent first, their client second, and whichever sucker club is going to buy their player third is not a difficult one to get your head around.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's been George Mendes apparently was involved in the Nicola Pepe deal in some way, so Arsenal dealing with those kind of agents has helped them get a player who's really exciting. Kiir Jurabchian is involved probably via Edu, because they have a relationship going back to Corinthians and those kind of things. It is a worry that maybe that side of the talent identification is going to fall by the wayside a bit. But Arsenal do have this stat DNA.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. That's in the Behrman book as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, the guy who sold it to them, maybe I'm getting mixed up, because there's quite a few of these sort of American analytics
Jason
guys.
Rosenfeld is his name.
He ended up going to like Villa with Tim Sherwood. Didn't work out.
No, I don't think so.
No?
No.
Did he end up at a lower league?
No, I mean, he's still running StatDNA from America.
Okay.
But Arsenal are using it for player analysis. They're using it for talent identification and what have you. But when people talk about the kind of players that StatDNA has helped identify, they're underwhelming signings.
Shamak.
That was before, but it was Gabriel.
No, sorry, actually, that's right. The Shamak thing, well, the reason Shamak came into my head is, in fact, that was what enabled them to sort of pitch successfully to Arsenal. Or like this was one of the things that, well, you know, to be honest, if we'd run the numbers on this guy, we never would have signed him. And Wenger was like, actually, yeah, this could be quite good. Like the point of the Wenger's idea was that what this thing will help us to do is avoid Shamaks, like these kinds of mistakes that sap a club.
Yeah, but you know? Apparently StatDNA also advised against signing Griezmann he was a Sociedad or before he'd even gone to Spain, you know? Yeah. So, I make a joke that it's basically malware. But we'll have to wait and see.
Well, the thing about it is, like, you know, you have to work with agents. Like
that's the reality, isn't it? You have to, as much as the data can send you in the right direction, you still have to get down and dirty with agents to make deals happen.
So which Premier League club spent most on agents last season?
Liverpool.
So they spent, the last figures had them spending £44 million on agents fees, which is like 10% of the turnover, but around that.
Yeah.
But phenomenal amount.
But they won the Champions League.
They got Van Dijk, they got Alisson. These men's agents are extremely wealthy now.
Yeah.
But like they, you know, the thing is that Liverpool are also, hailed as one of the most forward-thinking clubs analytically. You know, there was this gushing New York Magazine piece about them. Barcelona were like talking about how amazing Liverpool's, you know, physicists were.
They've got a throw-in coach and all that.
So they're kind of, but then they're also giving agents millions and millions and millions and millions of pounds. So it's essentially two halves of an integrated, holistic approach. The key to making it work, I think, is that the people have to kind of get on with each other and not be like, you know, get your tanks off my lawn, Mizzendat.
Yeah.
You know, which I get there seemed to be a bit of that between these guys. Mizzendat, I think, was coming in expecting to be kind of running the show. And instead it's like, oh, hang on. I'm like, do I report to this guy, or like, is he my boss now?
He was promised the role of technical director by Ivan Gazidis. That's where part of the problem was.
So it's one of those. One of those confused organizational flowcharts, and he eventually is like, okay, I'm out of here. And you know, the question is, you know, I suppose we'll wait and see the fruits of the other approach.
Mm. Edu and Raul Sanyahi. And Sanyahi has got it all to do in the next 24 hours. It's coming up on 5:25 on Wednesday, so it's just over 24 hours for Arsenal to fix their defense.
Or sign Coutinho.
No, thank you.
Imagine Coutinho as well arrives at Arsenal. It's like Coutinho, Aubameyang, Lacazette,
Mkhitaryan, Ozil, Pepe.
I mean, it's so crazy. It just might work.
I don't know that it would. But look, we better leave it there because we've been chatting.
We didn't talk about Tottenham at all.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, we can briefly if you would like to.
Well, I mean, they're obviously strong contenders for the Champions League
places, yeah.
Or maybe for the
doesn't Champions. Seem healthy between Pochettino and Levy.
There seems to be a bit of aggro, which is interesting because if you ever read, I just keep blurbing Guillaume Balague's books, but he did one with Pochettino as well. Pochettino's book, in which he first, was it when he first sort of laid out like his a series of his insane beliefs about like universal energy and stuff.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, you're kind of like, surely this is kind of, you wouldn't realize just how crazy this guy is in some ways. But like, in that, he's the stuff he says about Levy, like, there's never been a manager-chairman relationship like it. Like, backpacking together and stuff, you know, like, oh, Switzerland, Argentina, like, just
backpacking.
Well, like, absolutely, like swimming, like skinny dipping, you know. I mean, it's mad stuff. Like, in terms of, like, we're obviously business partners,
yeah,
but like we're really, really good soulmates as well. Whereas now he's kind of like giving it all this, well, maybe they need to change my job title, maybe I am not the manager, maybe I am merely the coach.
He's keeping his trunks on next time they go swimming, that's for sure.
But like they, you know, Levy like loves this image of himself as like, oh, the toughest negotiator in football. But like at the end of it is like Tottenham fail to sign most of the players they're looking for. So, you know, they leave themselves short. they fell just short of winning the Champions League last season, and maybe they should have signed somebody.
They did sign Ndombele, who's a good player.
Last year. Last season.
Yeah.
Maybe they should have signed somebody. Maybe it would have actually been worth, after all, giving Aston Villa an extra £5 million for Jack Grealish.
Who knows?
Maybe that would have been wise. But, you know, it's like Levy just wants to be known as the guy who, you know, no one ever gets the better of him in a deal. You know, it's like the opposite, the anti-Woodward, the anti-Ed Woodward, you know. And it sometimes seems to me as though that's almost the most precious thing that he has going into the transfer window, like almost guarding his reputation rather than like, what do we need to do to make the squad go? You see, Pochettino kind of is his own worst enemy in the sense of, like, he does drag performances out of players. Like, he is exceptional at this, you know. He can... Like, the Spurs last season was such a crazy season. They had 20 defeats and got to the Champions League final. Like, they were in the title race up till February when they just kind of collapsed. Yeah. But until then, it was like, it didn't matter who got injured. You know, Kane, Ali, Eriksen, whoever. The guys just come in and it doesn't matter, assemble in a new formation they've never played before with combinations of players that have never played together before and win the game. So it's an amazing thing that he's got. But... again, it just seems to me as though he's been kind of left. Seeing as you're so amazing, why don't you give us another demonstration of your almost supernatural abilities to extract performances from thin resources, Maurizio? Yeah. I think everybody here is really enjoying that.
Let's not help you. I'm on board with that. Anyway, look, we'll leave it there. Ken, thanks as ever. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
If you want to follow Ken on Twitter, you can do so. It's at Ken Earlies, at Ken Earlies. And Ken, of course, is part of the Second Captain's crew who do amazing sports podcasts throughout the year. They do a free football podcast on a Monday. The rest of their stuff is on Patreon. If you want to check it out, do so. SecondCaptains.com. That is the first of our Premier League preview podcasts. On Friday, as usual, we will have an Arsecast and we'll be looking ahead to the brand new season from an Arsenal perspective after the transfer window has closed and we have a full idea of what kind of squad we're going to have going into the new season. Will we have some new players? By the time you listen to this, we could have even signed some new players. Who knows? But join me and guests on Friday for the Premier League Preview podcast. Until then, take it easy, folks. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.